SEIU Minnesota State Council. Oral arguments from the attorneys. Would each of you be sure to introduce yourself for the record before each leg of your argument? You may proceed.
Hi, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name's Kelly Haddock, and I represent the appellant Madison Equities, Inc. in the matter before you this morning. We're here appealing two orders of the district court, one from September of 2022, which is the order granting the respondent's summary judgment. And the second order is an order where the court denied a motion to compel of the identification of various people who we believe are very important for testimony in this particular case. I just want to take a step back and want to set the stage because I think it's very important for all the issues that are before the court today. We have an employer here in St. Paul, Madison Equities, which is a management company. Back in 2018, 2019, did employ security guards for various properties. One was by the name of Christopher Lewis. He was paid $12 an hour. He was a recent high school graduate from 2017. He worked until August of 2019, starting sometime in 2018. So what happens? Mr. Lewis, at one point in time, believes he's got some complaints. He gets in touch with the union representative. Union representative and him then have some discussions, and specifically discussions saying, I want to go pin that mother, I'm not gonna say the last word. That's on page 93 of Mr. Lewis's deposition. Those are discussions exactly between the union representative and Mr. Lewis. They then, the union representative handholds Mr. Lewis and goes down to the Attorney General's office. And they have discussions with the Attorney General, both of them together. What else does the union do? The union's also cold calling other people who are maybe employees of Madison Equities, maybe not employees of Madison Equities. We don't know who those people are because the district court refused to provide and compel
the- Not alleging any of this as illegal or actually as it is in your complaint.
No, Your Honor, I'm getting to the
okay,
only claims
right.
that we
yeah,
have.
Yeah, yeah, you may want to move along to the
yeah.
Because I'm wondering, you know, how is any of this relevant to the analysis?
It's relevant to the analysis with a lot of their particular claims that we get lost in when we're talking about the Garmin preemption doctrine, as well as when we get to the defamation claim and some of the exceptions to the Garmin, if we would ever get to that point, where we would have to show some maliciousness on behalf of those parties that we believe provided the defamatory conduct. So ultimately that occurs. Apparently the union rep hears some of the discussions that were had between Lewis and the Attorney General, as well as discussions with others, and they get together and they decide to write an article and publish it to the world on the World Wide Web, which specifically one says, massive wage theft scheme alleged at downtown St. Paul buildings run by Madison Equities. That's the basis of one of the claims that we have, which was defamation.
So can I ask you a question? The most of the statements have the word alleged or claims were filed or, so why doesn't that save it from your perspective that it's an allegation?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the very simple answer to that is, and one that they run away from, is wage theft is a crime in Minnesota under 609.52 with very hefty penalties, up to 20 years in prison, $100,000 fines.
Right, but that goes to whether or not they have to prove damages as an element, or you have to, I'm sorry, I'm flipping parties here. You have to prove damages in order to recover on a defamation claim. I mean, that's all that goes to, right? Whether it's per se defamation or not.
Correct, but the issue is no massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged. There's no, that is a verifiable fact of whether any type of massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged by anybody. And you will see in the record that the respondents have no evidence of that, zero. And that's why they try to run away from the criminal element of this particular case.
How do you distinguish that from, you know, hyperbole, come from the, you know, the Martin case, and I know you distinguished that on the grounds that well, that relates to the anti-SLAPP statute. But it does just deal, part of it just deals with defamation and the line that is out of Post-Milkovich. Do you look at context? Do you look, you know, if there's hyperbole, if there's whatever. So what... Help us out here with why on that issue.
Number one, we're dealing with the allegation of a crime. Number two, this is specifically verifiable of whether any type of massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged. Do we know that?
So it's your allegation that unless the complaint or the issue, whatever they filed with the Attorney General's office, specifically said we think there's massive. I mean, there is in is it Mueller's affidavit or something that's in the record where one of the employees alleges that there may be hundreds of employees involved. I know that there's at least 50 or 60, I'm not sure the number, security guards, and that this has been the practice.
And that's part of the problem, which segues into our motion to compel as well, Your Honor, because to support a summary judgment motion, you got to provide admissible evidence. We have Jonathan Mueller's affidavit about what other people have said. That's all we have. That's hearsay upon hearsay.
My microphone's not on. I'm so sorry. But that's the complaint, right? I mean, that's what they're talking about, is what kind of complaint has been asserted, what kind of claims have been asserted. So it's not the truth of the claims, but this was filed to the point where, you know, and we've got a Minnesota Supreme Court decision saying there's enough here that we're going to allow this investigative demand to go forward.
Yeah, let me address that. There's never been a claim by the Attorney General filed against Madison Equities, Inc.
No, I know that. I'm just... But there was a challenge the Attorney General went into court to enforce its investigative demand. That's what I'm talking about.
Actually, Your Honor, that's incorrect. Respectfully, Madison Equities actually brought the lawsuit into district court.
I'm sorry. Okay, I knew
correct.
The issue was joined. Okay.
It was. They were served with the civil investigative demand. That was broad, and we thought it was overly broad. Under 8.31, it allows that person that the civil investigative was served upon to then bring the issue to the district court to determine if there's a reasonable basis for it and the scope of it. And ultimately, although the district court disagreed with us, the Court of Appeals, as well as the Supreme Court, did narrow the scope of the civil investigative demand. And just so the court is aware, the district court now has dismissed that case as of last week. So as we sit here today, there's never been a claim brought by the Attorney General's office related to this particular issue, and there is no active case with the case that we brought to have that issue addressed in terms of the discovery.
But how can we look at, you know, current facts in determining whether the challenge statements were false? Don't we have to focus on the facts at the time the statement was made?
Yeah, I that's right, Your Honor, and that's part of our challenge in terms of a summary judgment. The court's got to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is us. So what evidence exists with respect to, is that statement true or false? Remember, the court made a finding that all of these statements were true or substantially true. We believe that's an error because there's fact issues, certainly, if not dispositive in our favor. So massive wage theft scheme alleged, what facts exist that show that that's not true?
So what facts show that a massive wage theft was alleged?
Correct.
Okay, but then the record shows that one person came forward, reported these assertions, and said there are hundreds of other people who are in the same position. So isn't that an allegation that, you know, whether you call it significant, huge, massive, isn't that allegation that hundreds of people have the same complaint?
Mr. Lewis testified that there was only a small number. Then we asked, who was that small number that made those allegations?
He testified after the statement was made.
Correct. Only a small number was, existed.
Again, don't we have to look at the facts as they existed when the statement was made?
But we're relying solely on Jonathan Moeller's affidavit, which is hearsay upon hearsay. We wanted, in the motion to compel, to identify who these people are. What did they say? We don't know. Why do we have to simply rely on an attorney general that's so-called after our client? What are the motivations? We don't know any of those things because the district court denied our motion to compel the identity of these individuals. And specifically, even denied our motion to compel those identities of the individuals of who supposedly talked to the union outside of the attorney general investigation. And that's part of the problem, as we addressed in our brief, with the motion to compel and why there was an abuse of discretion. The district court judge issued an order saying denied, and a written memorandum will come in the future. No written memorandum ever came. So we're left here to guess at the reasons why it was denied. Was it denied because they liked the attorney general's office? Was it denied because there's some government data practices that might apply, which we said no way, especially when the conversations were had directly with the union outside of the attorney general? There was a whole myriad of arguments that were made with respect to that motion to compel. We just don't know why that exists. And we submit that if we would get the identity of these particular individuals, we could ask them what they talked about. It might very well be that the union was using their strong hand and saying, we need you to say X, Y, and Z. We don't care if it's true or not, but say X, Y, and Z. This particular union doesn't have a very good reputation with respect to at least one very large defamation award.
I guess whatever you say here is privileged.
So that's with respect to the summary judgment decision, we have to go back to the standard. Nobody ever alleged, there's no evidence in the record that a massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged to the Attorney General's office or to the union or to anybody. When we're talking wage theft, especially at a time in 2019 when the laws were changed, to include a criminal element to wage theft. They didn't put a civil wage theft claim was alleged, which they easily could have done because it went through an editor, et cetera, before they published this article. They wanted to get them. That's exactly what they said. How are they going to get them? They were going to get them by saying and doing anything and talking about a massive...
So do you disagree, though, that... Or what is your position on if the allegations of what happened, and I guess, forget it, I think I'm putting you in an unfair position with your client.
So again, back to the massive, they published this article without even ever trying to calculate the amounts. That comes directly from the Elliott deposition, page 103. They just took whoever said whatever, which we don't know because we don't know who said everything because they wouldn't disclose the identity of all the alleged individuals that said something, and just wrote this article without any verification whatsoever. And we would submit the facts of this case, if we ever get to them, will demonstrate exactly why the Attorney General's office hasn't brought a claim, because these things simply are not true. And they're simply, it's really not true that any type of massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged.
So if a newspaper had written the same article, the individuals, you know, had gone to the newspaper and say, hey, we just went to the Attorney General's office and this is what we told them, and the newspaper then reported employees allege, you know, and I will tell you from reading headlines, they are pretty hyperbolic in our news media, massive wage theft, then would you, setting aside New York Times v. Sullivan, et cetera, I mean, would that be defamation then? I mean, is there some difference that this was a union saying it versus somebody going to the news media? Because we see those stories all the time. Lawsuit filed claiming blah, 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 blah. So how is this different?
Well, a lawsuit filed claiming X, Y, and Z probably is true. Here, was a massive wage theft scheme ever alleged? We submit no, and there's no evidence that it ever was. That is absolutely a false statement of fact that's verifiable. And that's where the district court erred when it somehow determined, despite all the facts in the record that exist, especially in our favor, that somehow all these statements were true. That's a matter for a jury.
Sounds like a good place to wrap it up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Justin Cummins appearing on behalf of the respondents. Let me start with the Supreme Court, if I may. The Supreme Court and the litigation brought by the respondents specifically referred to the claims here as wage theft claims. The Court of Appeals did the same thing. This is a civil matter. The Supreme Court has recognized that. The Court of Appeals has recognized that. And it's generally recognized in the statutory regime of Minnesota that wage theft issues are civil.
Why does that matter, though, the issues we're dealing with today?
Right. Your Honor, I'm addressing opposing counsel's argument that somehow the speech at issue here was an accusation of a crime. It was not. It was an allegation that a civil violation had occurred. And I'll move on. I'll just point Your Honors to page... We address it squarely in the brief on page 19, the question of wage theft being a civil matter. The speech at issue here addresses the fact, reports the fact, that a number of employees of the appellant have gone to the Attorney General's office regarding wage theft claims, and we're pursuing them through the Attorney General's office. Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Mueller submitted an affidavit to the district court confirming that at least a half dozen employees are alleging wage theft. Now, in the appellant's eyes, half dozen employees alleging wage theft maybe isn't massive. But to the workers, I can assure you, who are living paycheck to paycheck, it is massive to them. But at the end of the day, as Your Honor alluded to earlier, the Supreme Court has been very clear that hyperbolic speech, loose language, as the Supreme Court says, that's protected, particularly in the context of a labor dispute. So what happened here is that the respondents told the truth. They said that workers are coming forward to the AG's office regarding wage theft. The Minnesota Supreme Court has confirmed that. The Court of Appeals has confirmed that. The speech is true. But even substantially true speech is also protected. So completely true speech is certainly protected. The fact, Your Honors, that this speech arose in the context of a labor dispute underscores the importance of protecting this speech. And in that regard, I'll quote the U.S. Supreme Court. The dissemination of information concerning the facts of a labor dispute must be regarded as within that area of free discussion that is guaranteed by the Constitution. That's the U.S. Supreme Court in the Thomas case we had discussed on page 45. And the reason for this is because it's understood, it has been for decades, that labor disputes can be contentious. Each side can be hurling accusations and insults, and as the Supreme Court said, abusive language. All of that is fair game in the context of a labor dispute. The understanding has been for decades that such speech, while less than ideal, is protected. But
if it's false, is it protected?
No, it's not. That's correct.
Isn't that the issue here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Seem to be going off track again.
So just to underscore how in this context there's more latitude, so certainly in this context this speech is protected. So for those
reasons... Your argument, I mean, setting aside the preemption argument, but is it your argument because there's a labor union involved that there's greater latitude than if these, you know, if somebody else was saying the same thing.
Yes, Your Honor, but more to the point, there is a labor dispute. When there's a labor dispute, that's the trigger. Whether a union's involved isn't necessarily the trigger for protection. The question is whether the speech concerns or arises from a labor dispute. If it does, then the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear that there's greater protection afforded.
So is that independent of preemption, then, whether or not it's preempted, federally preempted, that if it's part of a labor dispute, then there should be more leeway?
No, the labor dispute dimension is really in the context of preemption and whether the preemption defense applies.
So are we bound by law of the case? Because this court did issue an earlier opinion in this very case.
Thank you for bringing that up. What this court addressed then was whether at the Rule 12 stage the plaintiff had satisfied the heightened pleading standard. The garment preemption doctrine has two components. There's a heightened pleading standard at the Rule 12 stage, and then there's a heightened proof standard at the Rule 56 stage. So this court has not addressed the heightened proof standard. And that's why we briefed that, because the district court denied our motion for summary judgment on those grounds, and we believe that was an error based on the evidence that's in the record, that the appellant here did not provide, did not satisfy the heightened proof standard that governs.
So if we were to accept that this involves a labor dispute as defined under the National Labor Relations Act, then how is it, and did you brief this, how is it arguably protected by or prohibited by Section 7 or Section 8?
Right. We did brief this, and the conduct at issue is speech concerning wage disputes. That's the conduct at issue. That is protected concerted activity under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act.
But is there an unfair labor practice involved in there someplace? That's what I'm wondering.
Yes.
How do we, like, okay, it's a labor dispute, but how does it fit into Section 7 or Section 8?
Yes, so
that's where you're losing me.
Right. So Section 7 authorizes employees and unions to engage in protected concerted activity, which can include addressing wage theft or other types of compensation issues. So the garment preemption doctrine comes in through Section 7. The conduct at issue, speech about wage disputes, that's protected. So if the lawsuit is aimed at conduct that is protected, then garment preemption is in the picture. To try to put it maybe a different way.
How does the speech involve the rights of the employees to organize?
Well, so garment preemption is not limited strictly to organizing. The way that language in Section 7 has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court, by courts of appeals, is it's broader than that. The question is whether the employees are, in this case, and or the union, are raising issues about whether the employees have been paid right. And so that brings in garment preemption.
So is your argument really that the lawsuit is the problem, that it's kind of an intimidation tactic, the filing of the lawsuit?
Yes.
And so that's interfering with the concerted activity
Yes,
of the
exactly.
employees.
Exactly.
I guess. Okay.
Exactly. And the reason why this doctrine was developed like 70 years ago is because employers were coming into court seeking injunctions and litigating, frankly, in abusive ways. And the United States Supreme Court and on down recognized that the courts were not being used properly to address labor disputes. And so really the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is the entity that has the authority and the expertise to decide these types of issues. And both the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, and we quote both in our briefing, are very clear that deference needs to be given to the NLRB to ensure that federal labor law is applied uniformly. And the way to do that is not having state courts be the forum.
So is there any case law in filing an unfair labor practice against an employer for bringing a lawsuit like this?
Yes. It would be a run-of-the-mill unfair labor practice charge filed with the National Labor Relations Board, asserting that there's been interference with the exercise of Section 7 rights, protected concerted activity. And we have, in fact, filed those, not in this case, but in other cases.
And what was the interference here?
The interference here is the lawsuit.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. All right, and then if you'd address the exception, because let's say preemption applies, but it doesn't fall within an exception.
Yes, so there is a limited exception or exemption. And the question ultimately is, was there malice here, actual malice and actual harm? The actual malice analysis turns on essentially whether the speech was knowingly false or made with a high degree of awareness that it was likely false. And that's not true here. The speech concerns the fact that multiple employees came forward with wage theft concerns. And they were working with the AG's office in that regard. And they still are. And that suggestion that the AG's office is not going to take legal action against the appellant, I think, is, to say the least, speculative. But at the end of the day, this speech is true. And at the very best for appellant, hyperbolic. But that's protected. In the Austin case, U.S. Supreme Court case that we cite in our briefing, is very clear about that. Hyperbolic speech, loose language, abusive language, that's protected, as long as it's not knowingly false. So the appellants have to show actual malice, which they can't. There's no fact dispute about that. There's no fact dispute about actual harm. And for context, and we cite cases to this effect in our briefing, when employees or unions have described an employer is treating employees like slaves or as being Nazis, that is not deemed to be enough to cause actual harm. And here, what appellants allege in terms of harm, first, they lost a lease with Deed. Deed never had a lease with appellant. Deed testified that the speech at issue here had no bearing on their decision to end their lease. And perhaps most significantly, Deed decided to end their lease shortly after appellant sued them. They also allege damage to reputation. Months before the speech at issue here, there was an article appeared in City Pages reporting that the business community is, and this is a direct quote, leery of appellant's tactics. And in this very article, they talked about how there were reports, again, this is before the speech at issue, that a former appellant executive asserted that appellant overcharges tenants, misclassifies employees to evade their legal obligations, and commits ethics violations. This is speech.
Yeah, but you're kind of speculating on all that, like what harmed what, whenever. So if you'd move on with the rest.
Sure. And the last thing that they alleged in terms of harm were potential accountants. They said that some people who were applying for accountant positions were asking about this issue and so forth. But there's no evidence that any potential accountant actually turned down a job.
So in your last couple of minutes, if you could just, what is in the record? I mean, you heard counsel for appellant talk about, well, there's this affidavit submitted in another case by an attorney from the Attorney General's office. And then I know you've got the deposition of Lewis. And what is in the record to support these allegations that they're true?
Right. So what's in the record is an affidavit from Jonathan Mueller that says six different employees have reported wage theft, and they are investigating those claims. In addition, Mr. Lewis testified that he was aware of approximately the same number of employees who have been pursuing wage theft claims through the Attorney General's office. So that, in terms of employees coming forward, that's what's actually in the record. Now, we can debate about whether that's massive or not. That's frankly opinion. One person can say a half dozen employees alleging that they are not being paid what they're owed is massive, and another person can say that's nothing. But that's opinion, and that is not actionable. If your honors have no other questions, I will conclude. For all of those reasons, your honors, we respectfully request that summary judgment be affirmed on the basis that the speech was true or substantially true, and we respectfully request that summary judgment denial on preemption grounds be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think one glaring thing that steps out is how many times counsel referred to the employees. How do we even know they were employees? They won't disclose the identity. Why should they have the benefit of using all this stuff, employees, 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 and not allow us to know truly what they may have said?
So it is the argument that if the identity of the employees had been disclosed, you could have talked to them, and that might have revealed that, might have given you information to more forcefully argue that they knew these statements were false. They knew there was no massive claim.
Absolutely. Let alone a massive wage theft criminal. And its scheme also, if we look at the definition of scheme, talks about a large, I forget what it is, but it's certainly large and puts a number to it.
What was the reason for the court's ruling about non-disclosure?
We don't know.
Because he never followed up with a memo.
Correct. We don't know. Nothing said during the hearing in terms of the reasoning. We just don't know. Which obviously put, as I put in my initial brief, it puts us at a tough spot. Certainly puts your honors in a tough spot as well when we just don't know exactly what the court relied upon within that particular ruling. Despite saying one was coming.
What were some of the arguments against disclosure?
One was the Minnesota Data Practices Act and that somehow private information, which our argument against that was, there were private discussions outside of the Attorney General,
okay,
supposedly with all these people. It's in the record. It's in the depositions. We've cited it in our briefs. There was also some whistleblower protection arguments, and there was also some other, I can't even think of the name of it right now, but related solely to some governmental protections.
Okay, so those, I'm hearing three. Were those arguments briefed to the court by both sides?
They were all briefed to the court by both sides, Your Honor. Correct, and argued at the hearing as well. And we just never got a decision in terms of what the court was thinking or what it based its ruling upon. And that's the basis of our abuse of discretion with respect to the court denying the motion to compel and not given any reason for it. We just don't know. But beyond that, there's an abuse of discretion because, as we hear, they rely on all these employees, every argument they rely on. How do we even know they were employees? We know Christopher Lewis was not an employee at the time any of this was happening. That's counsel forgets that there's the undisputed testimony is there was no organizing activity. That comes directly from Lewis at page 76 and 77. There was no recruiting here by the union, page 183 and 184.
That doesn't really matter whether there was actually a union organizing campaign or not. I mean, the NLRA protects concerted activity.
Well, I think it does because there's an overarching theme in every case dealing with the NLRA. And the Court of Appeals here even addressed it back in March of last year. And the linchpin of the NLRA and the protections are some organizing activity relating to some employees. And here, they're not even employees, number one. And number two, the evidence says there was no organizing activity, let alone that it's false and should not be protected and should be at the state level because certainly the state has a strong interest in protecting its businesses against slanderous and defamatory statements. And two, I think counsel says all these employees alleged wage theft. Well, how do we know that? We've never had an opportunity to ask them. Wage theft. You look at Jonathan Moeller's affidavit, he doesn't come out and say they all said wage theft, let alone any type of scheme. It's very confusing and convoluted argument that I try to follow, but I just have a difficult time following it when counsel within their briefs. So with that, Your Honor, I think your counsel asked some very good questions, but we would request that the court reverse the decision which granted the respondent's summary judgment and also remand back to the district court either to compel the identities or compel the district court to actually issue a decision in terms of why it denied the motion to compel at a minimum.
How does the decision denying the motion to compel relate to the summary judgment determination?
It's everything, so to speak, because we can bolster our arguments even more to demonstrate to the court that these statements are false. So the court doesn't make a finding somehow that all these statements are true or substantially true, which again, we thought was error.
The prejudice to you of the wrongly decided decision on disclosure is that you weren't adequately prepared to respond to summary judgment.
Yeah, that's part of it. We thought we were good anyways, just given the standards and looking at the evidence that exists. But certainly they can't cut us off and then not allow us to take any discovery of them and then make a finding that these statements are true.
But you were the plaintiff, which means you should have known whether it was true or false when you filed the complaint, right? I mean, you can't kind of file a complaint and then do discovery to get the evidence later.
Yeah, well, we had a good faith basis to understand that.
Okay.
No,
it was
massive
just you
waste
wanted
that, yeah,
to have deposition testimony. I'm sorry for not knowing this. Was there any effort to subpoena documents from the AG's office? Did you do that or not? And I'm not saying you had. I'm not suggesting you needed to or anything. I'm just curious.
There wasn't at the time. At the time, Your Honor, the AG's, we produced over 18,000 documents to the AG's office. You don't. It's been we're hundreds of thousands of dollars having to deal with just the civil investigative demand, let alone to go fight them for those particular documents. And we did get the testimony in terms of what was provided to the Attorney General's office, and it's minimal documents that they that the so-called employees ever provided, which again shows, we believe, the maliciousness on behalf of the union in writing these particular articles, because it's simply not true, and there's no evidence that any massive wage theft scheme was ever alleged.
Thank you for your arguments and the briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the court's oral argument calendar this morning.